figure inside the attic space, leaning over what seemed to be a sickly person in a bed, helping him sit up and giving him the mug to drink. Esterhazy's heart quickened. Digging his walking stick into the soft ground, he made a circuit of the cottage, ending up on the far side. There was a small back door of rough wood that connected to a small kitchen garden, a shed, and a stone sheep pen. There were no windows on the back side of the house. He glanced around carefully. Nobody was to be seen. The infinitude of moor and mire on all sides was devoid of life. He pulled the small handgun from his pocket, ensured there was a round in the chamber. With great care, he approached the cottage from its blind side. Soon he was crouched by the back door. With a single finger, he made a small scratching noise on the wood and waited. Sure enough, the sharp-eared old crone heard it. He listened to her footsteps and unintelligible imprecations as she approached. A bolt shot back and the door opened. The woman looked out. A muttered oath. With one swift economical movement, Esterhazy rose, clamped his hand over her mouth, and dragged her one-armed from the doorway. He gave her a solid tap on the back of the head with the butt of the gun, then laid her unconscious body on the turf. A moment later, he had noiselessly slipped into the cottage. The ground floor was a single large room. He looked around quickly, taking in the enameled stove, the worn chairs, the antlers on the walls, the steep staircase rising to the loft overhead. A loud, stertorous breathing could be heard coming from above. It continued undisturbed. He moved around the small room with infinite care, placing each foot with fanatical caution, checking the commode, the single closet, satisfying himself that nobody was in hiding. Then, keeping tight hold of the gun, he moved over to the staircase. It was built of thick pegged planks, which might or might not creak. He waited at the bottom of the stairs, listening. The breathing continued, somewhat labored, and once he heard the man upstairs shift in his bed and grunt with what sounded like discomfort. Esterhazy waited, letting a full 5 minutes pass. All seemed normal. He raised a leg and placed one foot on the lower stair, began to put pressure on it, bit by bit, until his full weight was applied. No creak of wood. He placed his next foot on the higher tread, performing the same excruciating operation, and again there was no creak. With maddening slowness, he ascended the staircase in this fashion, consuming minutes of time, until he was almost at the top. The foot of a primitive bed was visible 5 feet away. He raised himself ever so slowly and peered over the top into the bed. A figure lay in it, back to him, covered, sleeping, his breathing labored but regular. He was a gaunt old man in a heavy nightdress, with white hair almost as wild and rumpled as the crone's. Or so it appeared. Esterhazy knew better. An extra pillow had been draped over the headboard. Putting his gun away, Esterhazy took hold of the pillow, and keeping his eyes fixed on the man in the bed, picked it up. Tensing, gripping the pillow in both hands, he crouched like a tiger, then suddenly pounced, landing on the bed, bringing the pillow down on the man's face, and leaning into it with all his strength. A muffled cry came from below, and a hand flew up, scratching and flailing at Esterhazy. But there was no weapon in the hand, and he knew his attack had been a complete and total surprise. He drove the pillow down even harder, the muffled sounds cut off, and now the weakened man struggled silently, his flapping hands plucking at his shirt. The body heaved below him, surprisingly strong for one so recently gravely wounded. One large spidery hand grasped the covers, yanking them this way and that, as if mistaking the covers for his assailant's own clothing. With a final heave of hands and legs, the covers came off, exposing his upper body. But Pendergast was rapidly weakening, and the end would come soon. Then something gave Esterhazy pause. The man's gnarly old hands. He stared in the dim light at the man's lower body, his spindly legs, the parchment skin, the varicose veins. There was no mistaking it. This was the body of an old man. Nobody could create such an effective disguise. But more than that was the absolute lack of bandages, scar, or anything remotely like a month-old gunshot wound on the heaving torso. His mind worked furiously to overcome the shock and fury. He had been so sure, so very sure. He quickly released the pillow, exposing the old man's distorted face, his tongue protruding, his eyes popping with terror. He coughed once, twice, gasping for breath, his sunken chest heaving with the effort. In a blind panic, Esterhazy threw the pillow aside and stumbled down the stairs. The old crone was just staggering into the back door, blood running down her face.
"You devil!"
she shrieked, grasping at him with bony fingers as he ran past, flinging open the front door and running back over the wide, empty moorlands. Chapter 22 Malforsh. The mild night air, sighing in through the open window, stirred the muslin curtains of the living room. Feeling the breeze on her face, June Brodie looked up from the Mississippi board of nursing forms she was filling out. Except for the low susurrus of wind, the night was quiet. She glanced at her watch, nearly 2 in the morning. Faintly, from the den, she could hear the sound of a deep-voiced narrator droning from the television. No doubt Carlton was watching one of the military history shows he was so passionate about. She took a sip from the bottle of Coke that sat at her elbow. She had always loved Coke, out of glass bottles. It reminded her of her childhood and the old-fashioned vending machines where you opened the narrow glass window and pulled the bottles out by their necks. She was convinced it tasted different in a bottle. But for the last decade, out in the swamp, she'd had to content herself with aluminum cans. Charles Slade hadn't been able to bear the way that light glinted off glass, and almost no exposed glass had been allowed on Spanish Island. Even the syringe barrels had been plastic. She replaced the bottle on its coaster. There were other benefits of returning to a normal life. Carlton could watch his television programs without having to wear headphones. Blinds could be opened wide, allowing light and fresh air. She could decorate the house with fresh flowers, roses and gardenias, and her favorite, calla lilies, without fear that their scent would provoke a desperate protest. She'd kept herself trim. She liked fine clothes and fashionable hairstyles. Now she would have a chance to wear them where others could see. It's true they'd had to endure more than